Odds that this is a red herring that we shouldn't pursue, high. But
probably.
What are the... With that acknowledged, hear me out. What are the odds that Brandon Sanderson did that on purpose? Put time at the beginning of the sentence because he knows we're on the lookout for this type of thing now, of suspicious capitalization. He's like, how can I hide this? I'll put it at the beginning of a sentence.
Uh-huh.
Welcome back to Following Know It Honest on my podcast. This week is episode 234, and we are in Wind and Truth chapters 21 and 22. Paul, how are you?
Marvelous. Excited to talk about some big things this week. Excited to talk about Dalinar, Zeth, Kaladin, and several others.
Elliot, how are you?
I'm doing great. I feel like episode 234 seems significant to me, but for no other reason than the numbers are in order, and I like that.
I agree. I apologize to all who are very much looking forward to it, as I was. I completely forgot epigraphs last week. I said we were definitely going to be diving into epigraphs, and I completely missed it. So it is highlighted in bright, hot pink on my outline on my other monitor here. We will not miss it. Paul, do we have a patron?
We do. We do. I'm excited to announce. And so I have to say, our patron will either think that my mug this week is funny or they'll be a little disappointed. I'm not sure. So I'll just get right into it. But we want to say a big thank you to Chris, who is an ardent. I wrote it big enough that you can hardly see it with the curvature of my mug. And I picked this mug before I knew who the patron would be. And I thought it was just a fun mug. I got this at like a Christmas party this year, and it's a lovely Barbie mug. So I've got my Barbie mug here to say thank you to Chris. So thank you, Chris. And, you know, if you've seen the Barbie movie, you are Knuff. And, you know, it's going to be great. So thank you, Chris.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
My two words for this week are for chapters 21 and 22, when in truth, are initial treatment.
Why?
I chose initial treatment mostly because, primarily it's a direct relation to Zeth and Kaladin. Their chapter, we're starting to see Kaladin kind of attempt this whole therapy session or questioning with Zeth. But it doesn't go super well. It's not very fruitful, but it's like an initial, like, you know, we're trying to break down those barriers, maybe like figure things out, test the waters. I chose that because I also feel that could be a little bit applicable to some of the situation that we have with our other characters. This is a little more of a stretch, but they're kind of making their initial plans and enacting things for how to deal with upcoming threats and things like that. So a little bit of stretch on that side, but primarily for the initial therapy session for Kaladin and Zeth. Kaladin to Zeth.
Yeah, he prods, but it doesn't get very far.
No, not at all. Yeah, that's the keyword initial, like a first little intro treatment might have been a good thing. Anyways, y'all know what I mean. Those are my words.
What about you, Elliot?
I do have two words. They are ambush and dust. And I'm not going to tell you what they mean because they have to do with two different major theories that I have for you guys. So I will get into them when we get there. Except for dust actually does have one relevant thing, which actually is going to tie into maybe what we're going to next, which is epigraphs. One of the epigraphs, Noadon, because they're excerpts from The Way of Kings, right? Written by Noadon. Noadon is rambling about dust for like three whole sentences, which in the epigraphs is a lot, like enough to make me notice that he's talking about dust. But there's another bigger reason I'm using dust, which we'll get to.
Sounds good. All right. Elliot, I'm going to throw it back to you. Can you give us a quick summary of what happened in 21 and 22 for those who haven't read it lately?
Yes, certainly. So just the two chapters, but one of them is quite long. In chapter 21, Shallan and her team of Lightweavers, they have disguised themselves as soldiers, and they travel with a troop of soldiers all the way to the Shattered Plains, to Narak, and they are tracking down the Ghostbloods. They find the Ghostblood hideouts, and they kind of stake out outside of the hideout. Then we jump back to a Sigzil point of view, which I actually really enjoyed. Lots of thoughts for you guys from the Sigzil point of view. And he's just kind of strategizing and figuring out what he's going to do as leader of the Windrunners with his objectives that he's been given from the generals. And then we go to this really cool like conservatory greenhouse room in Urithiru, and we start doing some even more like Council of Elrond kind of stuff where we're trying to plan out, all right, what the heck do we do now? Complete with Lyft and the Mink listening in, a la Merry and Pippin hiding behind the bushes, you know, the whole shebang. They come up with some crazy thoughts. They start to talk about Dalinar potentially ascending to honor and how that could be an option in the strategy here. And that's about as far as that chapter goes. I think there's lots to dig into. We'll get to it. And then chapter 22 jumps over to Caladan and Zeth, who have now arrived in Shinnevar and are starting to explore Shinnevar. Caladan's kind of freaking out. Why do all the plants not move? All this kind of stuff. They have the introductory therapy session that you guys were talking about, and that's about it there. A couple big drops of information there. And then we switch back to Dalinar point of view for the end of chapter 22, where he's like kind of going at it with the Stormfather, actually. Their relationship seems to have broken down quite a bit, actually. Some really fascinating bits, confusing bits there about the Stormfather, for sure. And I think that's it for 21 and 22.
Sounds good. All right, before we jump into 21, like Elliot said, it was a longer chapter in Wind and Truth. Epigraphs. I'm going to read epigraphs from the beginning of day one, or it's beginning of day two, all the way to chapter 22. And then at the end of day two, probably in two episodes, maybe three, we'll cover the rest of them. So I'll go ahead and read every epigraph we've had so far for day two. Here we go. Each of them are from The Way of Kings, fourth parable. As I approached the first crossroads, I met a family seeking a new life. This family did not speak my language, but we could both write glyphs, which proved facilitative in our conversation. As I shared their kindly cookfire, I learned some of their story. They had left behind family and hereditary home, something many would find unconscionable. What I learned from their glyphs, scribbled in dust, trembled my soul. It was because of me, the stories they'd heard of my teachings, that they had left. They'd gone to seek a land that some told them was mythical. A land where the king was a holy man and was concerned with the plight of the farmer beyond the appropriation of taxes. I let them pass with two lies. First, I dared not tell them this dusty traveler with whom they shared a meal was in fact the very king that they had heard of. The second was that I did not explain that very king had abdicated his throne and walked away from his kingdom. After we parted with affection the next day, I watched their cart roll into the distance, pulled by the father with two children riding in the rear, the mother striding with a pack on her back. Dust blew with them, for dust goes where it wishes, ignoring all borders. And that's what we have so far. Elliot, how many times was the word dust used in that two paragraphs?
Yeah, more than I recalled, even when I was really putting that as my word. He brings it up a couple of times. I'm assuming that's just like part of this extended metaphor that he's kind of spinning on this, and there probably isn't more deeper meaning behind that. I don't know. Maybe there is. Dustbren, is that a thing?
Well, we haven't really met many Dustbringers, so maybe... True. Maybe it'll cycle into that somehow. That's me hoping more than believing. But yeah, it was a bit comical how many times dust was used.
Maybe dust is just like people who walk a long way. They just become dust bringers. That's their ideals, is they just start walking.
Yeah, Abamabar to Urethiru or whatever is the prerequisite. That's to get from the first to the second ideal or something. Equivalent to Zeth's pilgrimage mission. They just have to walk really far.
So in the preview chapter episodes, we noticed this too. We covered epigraphs every week for two chapters at a time, and we noticed dust come up quite a bit. And I kind of dismissed it, but my other two co-hosts at the time did not. And if you recall the wind or the day one epigraphs, what was the big reveal with the day one epigraphs about the wind?
That the wind is a thing?
Yes, that the wind is like a spren, an ancient spren. So Tim and David lashed onto this idea that, okay, what if the night is, you know, an ancient spren? What if the dust is an ancient spren? What if the stones are an ancient spren? And we know from previous experience that the Shin people worship stones or believe that stones are sacred. And all of this kind of came together with going to Shinnevar. We're mentioning that we're now stepping on soil and not, you know, stone. And, you know, Zeth has an internal dialogue in chapter, 22 about it. And then back to these epigraphs. And then with the epigraphs we've previously gotten, there seems to be something older that's coming up more and more here besides honor, cultivation, and odium. It's more like our forces of nature are, you know, air, fire, water, nation, all converging or whatever. So do you guys think that's going somewhere, or do you think we just have a couple too many coincidences?
I think what I like about this is that we know the wind is a thing. But, okay, so I should say, frankly, I want this to be a thing. I think it sounds really fun and cool, the dust, the stones, the night. I feel like you could even say, like, the sky. I know it hasn't been mentioned too much, but periodically the sky is mentioned, as well as it being akin to a radiant order, so...
I mean, I'll back you up there. Kaladin claims the skies more than a couple times, right?
And the skies belong to him type of thing. Yeah. But that sentiment I think is really cool and I really like. But I'm struggling to actually see how that could play into things, other than if it somehow connects back to our rule of 10. Our unmade, our heralds, our something, our orders. If there's something like that where it's like maybe there's 10, I don't know, let's call them origin spren or something like that, there's 10 of these that somehow the magic of system of honor being this surge binding, if that was connected to them somehow, I could buy that. I think that'd be cool. But I'm not sure, other than a scenario like that, I'm not sure how it could play into things. It'd have to be some kind of explanation for the magic system. Maybe that would indicate why Stormlight doesn't work off of Roshar or things like that, to my knowledge, because maybe the dust and the wind aren't there. I don't know. I hang my hat very loosely on that theory. I don't feel very confident that is legitimate. I kind of think we're overreading it.
I actually like where you went with that, equating it to the 10 orders and how each of the 10 orders could have like a corresponding mother patriarch spren type thing. I don't hate that idea. You'd have to kind of stretch for some of them, like Will Shapers and Else Callers might get a little weird, but I mean, Windrunners, Skybreakers, Dustbringers, like the Stone Wards, those check out.
One of the things I thought of actually right after you said the wind and the night was this book is titled Wind and Truth. Truths are obviously a big deal. It would be a little dicey because in my head, if hypothetically, let's say there's a spren called the Truth or something along that line, something akin essentially the Truth, right? You then have Truth Watchers, and then you have the cryptics of the Lightweavers who are all about truths. So I feel like it gets a little muddy that maybe it'd just be for the Else Caller or the Lightweavers and Truth Watchers have something different. Who knows? I think that would be kind of neat, but also I'm not convinced right now. I'm not going too far down that trail, but it would be really cool. I cannot deny.
And just to throw another wrench in it, you also have the Night Watcher along with the Truth Watchers. So if the night was a spren, and it gets really very confusing very fast.
Maybe that means cultivation is the night. It's definitely not it. We're definitely going further away, I think.
That wasn't the direction I was going, but.
But yeah, I think that's fun.
Well,
fun trail.
Maybe, because I think this is absolutely a thing, because the sibling talks about this, that in chapter 21, the sibling spends a bit of time dissecting this a bit and uses these specific terms, night, wind, and stones, and they're capitalized, all of them. And the sibling is referring to them as like things. It's pretty clear. It says, the sibling says, the Night Watcher came from the night as the Stormfather came from the wind. And then later on, I formed from the stone, which was the sibling of wind and night. That seems really clear to me that at least stone, wind, and night are going to be like beings of some kind.
Sure. And now, so this conversation is had with Jasnah, and Jasnah is trying to parse some history. Jasnah's just like in her head is like, okay, so we jumped over 6,000 years ago, and then turns and asks the siblings, hey, when were you born? The sibling says 7,000 years ago. And Jasnah then corrects the sibling about their own birth and says, no, that can't be possible because Odium wasn't even here. Like Odium, Honor, and Cultivation weren't even here yet. So they specifically say in the chapter, something is missing here. We've got some incorrect information somewhere. We need to go find it.
All right. I was going to save this for later, but we're talking about it now, so we should just go for it. The inconsistencies that you're talking about, the dates not lining up, all points to the Stormfather. What the sibling is telling us seems to check out. It's what the Stormfather is telling us that does not check out. Because the sibling says, I was born 6,000 years ago, shortly after the Stormfather. The Stormfather was born like right before me. And then Jasnah says, the 7,000 that you were talking about, the Stormfather claims to have been there 7,000 years ago when stuff was happening before that. So that's the inconsistency. But it comes down to what the Stormfather is claiming. Now, fast forward. Chapter 22, down to like the little spat that Dalinar and the Stormfather have. Did not actually write down what page number this is, so I'm going to have to find it. There's a section, so we'll probably get into this more in a second, but I'll just reference one thing real quick. The Dalinar is kind of questioning the Stormfather and like his motives. What are we doing? Why are we doing this? He's noticing some inconsistencies or some weirdness. They end up talking about the heralds. And then the Stormfather says, oh, I can't find it, but it's in my notes. He says, time has broken them. I've broken them. He's talking about the heralds.
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing. Time is capitalized, but it's the start of a sentence.
I was going to say it's at the beginning of the sentence. The same thing happens with dust. The same thing happens with dust.
So I passed over the first time, not even thinking about it because it's the start of a sentence. But then as I started taking notes on the whole night and wind and stones thing, I came back to that sentence where it says, time has broken them, I've broken. And this is right in the middle of where the Stormfather is saying like lots of weird things. Dalinar's like, what? Like your plan? Who are you? You know, all these things. What if the Stormfather is not of the wind, like the sibling thinks that the Stormfather is, or maybe the original Stormfather was of the wind, and this Stormfather is not of the wind, but is actually of time?
What? Okay. Odds that this is a red herring that we shouldn't pursue, high. But
probably.
What are the, with that acknowledged, hear me out. What are the odds that Brandon Sanderson did that on purpose? Put time at the beginning of the sentence because he knows we're on the lookout for this type of thing now of suspicious capitalization. And he's like, how can I hide this? I'll put it at the beginning of a sentence.
Uh-huh.
Having that right next to night and wind and those stone right next to those, it really makes you think or gets those wheels turning. I'm disappointed in myself right now. This is the first, like, I love these rabbit trails and I love this one, but this is the first one. I'm like, no, I just don't think, I don't think that's it, you know? And my logical brain is kicking in and is like, no, that's not likely, you know, not likely that time is a thing. However, I did think of, which I think I quickly convinced myself otherwise, but if we're talking about these, I'm calling them primal spren. We can come up with another name or something. These notable spren. I thought of, what's his face? The guy who sits in the fountain. I always think back to him and the mysteries of that guy. The big spren in the fountain. Is it in Eerie?
Oh.
What's his name? I can't remember.
Cusakesh.
Or something. Yeah, Cusakesh. I always think of that. I don't think Cusakesh is some like what we're talking about here, but that type of thing. I'm like, I could see if that was a cool reveal later in the book that like Cusakesh is related to, I don't know, insert other important primal type spren per this conversation.
Well, okay.
I don't think that's the case, though, because we know a little more about Cusakesh.
So, big, like, undefined entities on Roshar, there's more than a couple. And if we're going to classify them, I think we could go down this route. There's those massive great shells that hang out in the Reshi Isles that the Reshi, like, worship. That we met back way back in the Words of Radiance epilogue or interlude. There's some sort of mysterious massive beast in the High Storm that Dalinar makes a rude gesture to, going from tent to tent. Do you remember this back in Oathbringer?
Yes, I do remember that.
Never brought up again. Never defined. Like you're just supposed to assume it's the Stormfather, but you know, moving on. I don't know what that was about. We have the origin and the big whirlpool there. We have, you know, we can bring up Mr. Kremling Man maybe in this conversation if there was all one entity. Yeah. So bunch of like original primal spren kind of hanging out in the shadows on Roshar. Completely feasible to me. I mean, I feel like we've kind of seen them in the shadows, just nobody really pays attention.
Do I think we're on to something super big? Yes, but no. But is this incredibly awesome and do I want to see this come to fruition? Absolutely, yes. I'm really hoping that we get the dust or the stone or something of that nature. The one another thing that kind of deters me from this is if the sibling is able to bond Navani and the sibling is in that category, then are we also maybe creating these other primal spren that could create other bondsmith type characters? It seems a bit rocky there. So to me, it doesn't add up enough.
I'll actually attack this. So it's been defined for us that there are three bondsmiths, period. Within the structure of the Knights Radiant, there are three bondsmiths. Well, okay, what about before the Knights Radiant? We're talking about types of stuff before the official Knights Radiant was formed. Well, what if we're talking about 10 or 12 bondsmiths? That could be a thing.
And hold on a second. I don't honestly know the answer to this question. Is it the Stormfather that has told us there's only three?
It might be.
Because I don't really trust that guy anymore.
That's a great question. I mean, there's a lot of our definitions about old Knights Radiant stuff that have come from the Stormfather, which we assumed was a reliable narrator up until about three chapters ago.
I kind of want to talk about this. Can we talk about the Stormfather for a second?
Yeah.
Well, first, I just want a blanket prediction from each of y'all. Do you... So I read this and I absolutely became more skeptical of the Stormfather, more of a case for the Stormfaker. It's a bit rocky, bit icy, you know, not very clear. But do we really think that, do you think that it is going to come out that the Stormfather is fake and telling lies, maybe strategic lies, things like that, and really uproot everything that we know? I'm actually curious because I've wrestled with this. I'm like, I could see the rug being pulled out from us and just realizing that nothing that we've been following is, or at least some integral pieces were falsified, where we're stretched or diminished something. But I'm also like, no, I don't think so. I feel like this is a misunderstanding trope with the Stormfather. It's kind of where I'm resting my case. I've had a tough time. I really can't decide. If like one more chapter comes up that like points to it, I'm gonna be like, well, I guess he is fake. You know, there's been a lot. Stormfather has a lot of allegations pointed at him right now.
All right, so two parts to this in my answer. One is my kind of my meta answer, which I'll save for last. The second one is the line in chapter 22 where the Stormfather admits to some embarrassing truth back in the day, or you'll see our shame or something like that. And that makes me lead to, okay, if the Stormfather is unreliable, what is he doing and why? Which would then lead me to think, all right, now we're going to go learn about Tanavast. And what did Tanavast do to tell the Stormfather to set all this up? Because in the prologue, we learned that Gavilar was trial X minus one, if Dalinar is X. How many were there before that? You know, how long has this been going on if we've been sending visions to some people trying to ping certain people around Roshar to be the Stormfather bondsmith? So there's something fishy going on with the Stormfather, absolutely. I think it actually ties back to Tanavast, though. I've become more suspicious of Tanavast because of this, and I was like a huge fan of like the idea of Tanavast and honor and dying for the human race on Roshar. Like that was really cool to me. I'm very curious about that. My more meta answer is also yes, and Brandon Sanderson in the original rough draft release of Stormlight 5 prologue, there were a bunch of weird things about the Stormfather, and this is what started this all for us. I think that was intentional to just kick out the idea of look out for the Stormfather, planting that seed of we're going to do some stuff with the Stormfather in this book, get ready for it. A lot of that was like polished out of the final published draft, but I think that's what that was, of planting the seed in the readers of look out for the Stormfather. We're going to go somewhere in this book with him. And then it was kind of toned down later.
Well, it feels to me like a lot of that got moved to this chapter right here, chapter 22. Yeah. Yeah. Like, not the exact same dialogue. It's more like the suspiciousness was cleaned out of that early dialogue and then added here, where now Dalinar is really starting to poke at the inconsistencies and the, hold on, three sentences ago you just said this and now you said this. Like, we were picking up on some of that in that original version of the prologue and it got changed. So I'm with you. I think we're supposed to be very suspicious here. I'm full on extremely suspicious. I am now all the way back in the Stormfaker camp of this. I think this is the Stormfather, but I think it's going to come out that the Stormfather was not who we thought he was, and that his motive, this is heavily hinted at in this chapter. I think his motive is not what he's claiming it is. What is going on here and why? I don't know. It's even unclear here because he seems to be trying to steer Dalinar away from pursuing the Shard of Honor. But like, why? What's the motive then? What is the Stormfather trying to accomplish? I don't know.
I have been wondering about this a lot. The main question is, what is the Stormfather's motives? Because Dalinar talks here about like we need to do something drastic. We need to pull out all the stops that we can and find the Shard of Honor and find answers because we are outmatched and everyone is relying on me, right? Like, we've got to go do anything that we can. And the Stormfather is basically just like, he gets pretty wishy-washy and is like, no, you can't think this way. You need to basically be quiet and wait. There's almost a little like toxic communication. He's like, you have to be quiet because you're being tested. You know, like, you're being tested. You were so close to like being chosen or something along those lines. Like, you can't want for it. Which I want to ask y'all about. Do y'all think that is legitimate? Because it's very, I think that dialogue, it is very possible that the Stormfather is telling the truth, that you can't necessarily go like seek out and take the Shard of Honor, but like, you know, because doesn't it say that the times that we've seen characters pick up a shard, doesn't it sort of say that the shard like accepts the person, like the power, someone yes. accepts the holder?
Well, and I think that's actually a big thing in Secret History, if I remember correctly, that preservation accepts Kelsier like on a temporary level because it knows it's trying to get to Vin, and it helped, like, there has to be a mutual contract connection between shard and vessel. I think they actually mentioned that in this chapter, that you have to like convince the power of honor to accept you is brought up.
So Dalinar is going pretty off the chain, telling the Stormfather off of like, basically, I've had enough of this. Wait, like, we've got to do something now. I'm very eager to see how this goes next time we get to see Dalinar. I really want to know, you know, where we really go from this. Dalinar is stubborn enough. I think he's in, you know, he's talking with the Stormfather, who is a big deal, right? The Stormfather is a big deal. But Dalinar's talking to the Stormfather, and I feel like butting those two against each other, I feel like Dalinar is gonna win. He's been kind of the most relentless of will, relentless of approach, I feel, of any of our characters. So I'm very there's a lot of things in this book that I'm obviously very much looking out for. I think this like went up several notches. You know, I'm excited for the contest of champions and everything, but now simply the dynamic between the Stormfather and Dalinar, I'm very, very eager to see what's next. Because Dalinar always does a good job of, you know, I think back to the chapters where him and Taravangian would talk ethics and things of that nature. It's not the same here, but I feel almost a similar battle of the minds or wills. I don't know what you want to call it, but all in all, like, I'm really tuning in for this. I don't know. Like, aside from even the argument of maybe this is not the Stormfather, let's assume this is the Stormfather, just this dynamic of, no, you can't pursue this, and I have to pursue this. Where does that go? I'm very eager to see.
Yeah, the relationship between Spren and Radiant has always been interesting in how it varies, and Dalinar even brings it up of, I wish I was more amiable with my Spren than everybody else seems to be, and kind of wishes he had a better relationship with the Stormfather. We can talk about the contest in a second because he does bring it up. But one thing I wanted to bring up in this dialogue between the Stormfather and Dalinar is the Stormfather drops Gavilar's name, and it completely throws Dalinar. This is not new information for the reader. It's absolutely new information for Dalinar, though. The Stormfather kind of just really angry offhand says, you were supposed to be better than your brother. Why are you pursuing this? And Dalinar's like, whoa, hold on, hold the phone. What about Gavilar? What does Gavilar have to do with any of this? So I think that's very interesting that Dalinar is finally going to maybe learn more about Gavilar, and he's not the guy that he put his, like, Gavilar is on a pedestal for 99% of Alethi, with the subtraction of, I don't know, the Ghostbloods and the Sons of Honor and Navani. But Dalinar, I think, is going to learn exactly who Gavilar was, especially by the end. And I think that's in our near future, too.
Just one more thing I'll throw out there before we probably need to move on to other sections of these chapters. Brainwave hit me as we were talking about this. The sibling specifically describes the Stormfather as of the wind. The sibling is talking about, like, I'm of the stones, the Night Watcher is of the night, the Stormfather is of the wind. The wind is what called out to Kaladin at the very beginning, saying, come to me. I wonder if that's going to play into the whole, like, something's not right here. If, like, that relationship between, let's say the Stormfather is the OG Stormfather and of the wind, and, like, Stormfather is hiding important facts, wind is calling out for help, like, Stormfather is acting against its mother, the wind, somehow.
Okay, there's a line in the day one epigraphs that's really bothered me up until you said that. Talking about the wind, whoever's writing Knights of Wind and Truth writes, Kaladin listened, and he wasn't an edge dancer, but did a fine imitation of their oaths or something like that. And I'm like, okay, hold on, wait a second. Edge dancer? What does edge dancer have to do with this? Now it makes me think, is the wind calling Kaladin to come heal the Stormfather? Would an edge dancer be better equipped for that, but Kaladin does just fine?
Maybe. Maybe. Something's going on there. There's going to be a big revelation about the identity of the wind and the Stormfather. I think that's coming.
Let's circle back to the contest. They have a little bit of a discussion about the contest in Chapter 21. And Jasnah brings up so if the contest isn't what we think it's going to be, how can we change it? Can we change the contract? Can we get out of the contract? Et cetera, et cetera. And they bring up the fact, what if we backed out of the contract and let Odium leave? That Jasnah brings that up. And Wit turns to her and says, you can't be serious. That's rule number one of we have to keep Odium on Roshar. And Jasnah says, that might be your rule number one. That is not my rule number one. we don't have to delve into that too much, but real quick, gentlemen, where do you think that's going to land? Is the contest even happening at this point? I feel like the stakes of the contest since the beginning of the book have gone like way down to me. Like, I thought the contest was like super important, but now it's like borders on Roshar, and the stakes between the contest happening and not happening seems to be bigger than winning or losing now to me. Do you guys feel the same or not?
Yeah, it feels a bit like the rules have been changed. I didn't fully understand all of the rules that so they have their big meeting, right, where Hoyt is like, we've been tricked, there's a loophole in the contract, and essentially it's like, any y'all can correct me afterwards, this is my understanding right now, my understanding is all these like major cities, like the capitals of these kingdoms, if you will, if Odium has control of those, then he basically gets them, like, in some way, shape, or form.
He controls the whole kingdom. So if you, yes, whoever controls the capital controls the empire.
Yes. And that to me felt a little out of left field. It felt like we're having a very different game than we're playing here. I will say, I'm not counting that as a bad thing. It's different from I expected, which, you know, of course I'm not going to correctly predict this book as we came into it. But my prediction was going to be that the Contest of Champions would be more of a first half of the book concern, and then we would be dealing with massive ramifications of the aftermath and kind of from the ashes situation. That's not what we have, which is not a problem. I was wrong. That's okay. That's expected. But instead we have kind of a unique, like, okay, we have to fight all these battles on all these different fronts while we prepare for the Contest of Champions. But it sounds like by the time that the Contest of Champions happens, the land of Roshar may already sort of be determined. I'm not sure. Also, you're welcome to talk about that first, but I have a question of, I feel like some land has to go. I feel like we can't win on every front, especially if they've talked up how much in peril all of Roshar is and how they have to try to divide up resources well to do things. I think it's possible, but to me, I feel like they, with that change, should be in like dire trouble. You know, I'm curious to know what y'all think.
I absolutely think we're going to be spread too thin. And this actually can swing us into our Sigzil point of view. I think Sigzil is in big trouble. I think Sigzil and our army of Windrunners are in big trouble. This is going to get kind of morbid kind of fast. I have vocalized my frustration that there's too many Radiants on Roshar by like the end of Rhythm of War. It doesn't feel special anymore. That may not be the case by the end of Wind and Truth. If we're losing one of these battles, my first bet is on Sigzil, I think, and my second bet is on Adolin in Aesir. Yeah. Which might actually lend more credence to trying to back out of the contest, actually, because if you lose the capitals, and then the day before you don't have any land on Roshar anyway, why are you doing the contest? If you don't have any land on Roshar, just back out of the contest and then fight for your capitals again. I hope that's not the case. That's kind of lame and boring, but I could feasibly see that.
So this is where one of my two words comes in. My word was ambush. You're asking Paul, like, which of the battlegrounds do you think we're going to lose? And the three we've talked about so far are Aesir, where Adolin is going, the Shattered Plains, where the Windrunners and Sigzil are going, and Thalen City, where Yasna is going.
Yes. and the Stone Wards.
Yes. I think I had a thought the other day. I've thought of something that our master strategists in this book have not. And I think it could be a huge problem. They are sending all their troops out of Urethiru. They've talked this multiple times. They're like, should we leave people back to defend Urethiru? And the sibling says, no, I got this. Fuse, take one step in my vicinity, and I can incapacitate them instantly. Plus, I've got Lifelight, the Radiants that are here. I can superpower them. We're fine. There's a big assumption that's being made there, and that's that the attacking forces are going to be fused. What are they forgetting? Can you guys think of it?
Skybreakers.
Exactly. They are assuming that the Skybreakers are going to be with the forces. I think they think that the Skybreakers are going to be at Thalen City.
I think so.
Because they talk about like having the Windrunners use the Oath Gate to bounce back and forth between the Shattered Plains and Thalen City, depending on kind of where they need them. What if the Skybreakers don't show up to either one of those and all the Skybreakers attack Urethiru? What if the Skybreakers show up to Urethiru and can feed off the Tower Light and become superpowered themselves, and this super shield that the Tower think that sibling thinks they have is actually going to enable a massive ambush by the Skybreakers?
Could I also throw the Dustbringers in there? We don't have like any Dustbringers, and the one we had was with the diagram. So what if Taravangian was hiding his Dustbringers?
Ooh.
And they'll show up at the tower.
Okay. So flashback to the strategy chapter, the one that I talked about was too boring and probably should have gotten edited down.
Uh-huh.
There's a random throwaway mention in there. Do you guys remember it? There's a king of the Reshi Isles who like sneaks in the door at the end, like as the meeting is starting, and they're all like, who are you? And he's like, oh, I'm a king. Oh, okay. Guess you can stay. They mention he's the only Dustbringer they have.
Uh-huh.
I don't know where to go with that, but they have one, and that one listened in on the strategy meeting.
Uh-huh.
Now I'm even more scared.
That is a pretty easy way for Brandon to be like, yep, he was actually not with good intent. And yeah, now there's a bunch of Skybreakers and Dustbringers at your doorstep. So I did not think of that. I did not think of Urethiru. What does that mean? If Odium takes control of Urethiru, is it just Urethiru, or is there a kingdom connected to that?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, Urethiru is a big deal.
It might be the Knights Radiant. He might be in charge of... He might win the Knights Radiant.
Oh, because Dalinar has stood it up as like this kingship that he's the king of.
And that would certainly feed into Taravangian saving them all if he includes Urethiru. Interesting.
Yeah. So, to answer your question directly, Paul, I think Shattered Plains and Thalen City might be fine because the sneak attack is coming at Urethiru. I still do worry about Adolin. I do think Adolin's going to lose his battle.
I have big worries for Adolin. And so getting into the Sigzil point of view, Sigzil is trying his best to impersonate a commander. His internal dialogue is telling him he shouldn't be here with kings from all over the world and people he's written books about, or not read books about, and stuff like that. And he has this specific comment in his head where he says, I need to make sure I don't spread my Windrunners too thin. Jump forward in the chapter. The general of Herdaz, the Mink, I don't remember his actual name, has like a trump card on Dalinar and says, hey, you promised that we'd take back Herdaz. Give me Windrunners now. And I was like, huh? Like, okay, I understand. Why is there a time frame on this suddenly? Why is the Mink like, you need to uphold your oath to me right now? And I know you included me in your contest or whatever. Everybody knows you're going to lose your contest. We need to go take back Herdaz right now. And I'm like, this seems really fishy to demand Windrunners away from the other battlefields to go take back Herdaz right now. Did that flag for you guys?
So yes, I had concerns about this. I think less major than you are mentioning. Less major concerns or bells went off in my head. It is interesting, I think, that the Mink would ask for this. That the image I got was like, whatever crisis happens and people go, they're like, I need to withdraw my money from the bank type of thing, or from the market, whatever it is.
Sure.
Like a safety thing. I need to take back. I need to make sure I don't lose anything. Obviously, he's talking about the entirety of Herdaz, which is a big deal. But that type of frantic, like, impulse, gotta pull out. Like, I've got to protect what I can and have right now. He definitely knows that Dalinar, if anything, will stick to whatever his word is and does that. This is an episode where I have just not run with the ball, but I'm like, I don't think it's actually like a major play or a major deal. I think that we will maybe see ramifications of that from other places, like Sigzil maybe feeling like what his Windrunners were stretched too thin, things like that. I think we'll see ramifications. And it is interesting. What was it written? Like, did we read the part where Dalinar makes this promise to the Mink in the past?
Yes. Yeah,
I didn't remember it off the top of my head. Okay.
Because we rescue the Mink at the beginning of Rhythm of War, bring him to the tower. He agrees to help it in the battles in Rhythm of War with the contingent of, once we're done with all these battles, we're going to go after Herdaz. So he includes Herdaz in the contract.
Okay. Which makes sense. And if there's anything about Dalinar's character, it's that he's going to remain true to his word and what he promises people. He even says to, like, Yasna at the end, right? Like, basically, like, he knows it was a hard decision. It probably wasn't even the right thing to do, but he's got to do it because he's got to honor a promise he made, right?
And Paul, you just said a very specific word, which is where my brain went. Honor. Right before this scene where the Mink, like, calls in the promise, they spent like four pages talking about, can Dalinar even ascend to honor? Is that even possible? And Wit's part of that conversation. They talk about, well, would honor even have you? Would honor even, you know, would this work? And Wit's like, well, you really have to, you know, be all in on this. You'd have to be able to demonstrate that you can be honor. Blah, 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 blah. They go on and on. And then the very next thing that happens is somebody calls in an oath that Dalinar has made. And he instantly goes to, oh, well, I have to fulfill that. I have to complete that. It seemed to me like the characters aren't noticing it in a minute, but it seemed to me like that was our evidence right there. Can Dalinar be honor? Well, he's showing it to you right here. That felt like, well, that's what that piece of that scene was doing for me, was, okay, put his honor to the test. Is he going to do it? Well, yeah, he's going to do it. He kind of defaults to that, which was kind of pointing to the fact that it kind of solidifying in my mind, well, ooh, I think Dalinar could be honor. But I didn't think at all about, Trevor, where you were going with this, which is maybe this isn't quite as open face as I was kind of taking at it. Maybe there is something sneaky going on here and is setting Sigzil up to fail.
Well, yeah, setting Sixel up to fail. I'll come back to that in a second. But going off of what you said, I think it's really interesting that we got this chapter from Yasta's point of view, or at least a section of it.
Yeah.
Because she has no value in the deities of shards. She does not value, she's a self-prescribed atheist and says the shards are just higher beings with higher power, not deific beings. So honoring your contract being honorable has way less weight for Yasna than it does for Dalinar. Now, the reason why I keyed into this in the first place is because there's a one-liner in Sunlit Man that I'll read for you. And it's stuck in my brain ever since I've read it. I am on the lookout for Sigzil getting stabbed in the back by something, and here it is. "Thank you for caring about my sister," Rebecca said. "I have empathy for abandoned soldiers," Nomad said, "being one myself." And they move on. And I keep thinking, okay, what situation is Sigzil going to be put in this book where he is in a lose-lose and he gets abandoned? I think he's going to get understaffed at the Shattered Plains. Back to what you said, where the Windrunners like bounce back and forth of where they're needed, Sigzil might just be straight up abandoned on the Shattered Plains and with a very bare-bones situation that was not originally planned for.
That could absolutely play out. I forgot about that line from Sunlit Man, because imagine this seems incredibly plausible. Some of the Windrunners go to Thalen City, let's say, to back up Yasna, and Sigzil all of a sudden starts losing and he calls for his backup reinforcements, and Yasna says nope, sorry, I'm gonna make the tough decision to sacrifice you so that we can win this one and not just lose both. And that could absolutely be the scene that he's reflecting back on.
Okay, that's really interesting, because the Shattered Plains is Alethi land. And Yasna is the queen of Alethkar.
Yeah.
So Yasna has stakes in the Shattered Plains. And if Yasna makes the call to back out and hose Sigzil, then Yasna is without a kingdom moving into the back half. Really correct. Interesting.
But remember, and she says it in one of these chapters here, Yasna is the utilitarianist.
Right.
She will make every decision she makes based on what is the most good for the most people.
Yes. I noticed that line too.
Did you guys... one last thing that I had in my notes from chapter 21. Did you guys catch the reference to Sel?
Where the god dies and they stuff it in a closet or something?
Yeah. There's a section that this is where they're talking about like Dalinar ascending to honor and like what the implications of that are. Yada yada, Dalinar's asking questions, which they're kind of answering them. And he asks the question of like, well, what happens when you leave a shard's power without a person? Like, what happens? And Wit goes, well, that has happened. And he says, it's different on each world. On one, it was all around and we didn't realize it. In another, the god's power was stuffed in a metaphorical closet, packed into Shadesmar, left to rot. He clearly is mentioning two different planets where two different shards have been like killed and left without. I'm trying to see what the exact like scenario is they're talking about here.
I mean, one is Scadrial and one is Sel, almost certainly, right?
Well, that was what I was going to ask you. Oh, yeah, so here it is. The question right before, what happens to the power of a god when they die? Okay, so that's the question, is when a god dies, what happens to the power? And that's the answer that Wit just gave him. And it took me a lot of thinking, actually, to realize that the one where they're talking about stuffed into Shadesmar, that is Sel. And it took a little bit of research for me to get to this, but if you pull up Arcanum Unbounded, Chris like explains this to us in pretty much the same kind of verbiage here. I'll just read it real quick. I am. This is Chris speaking in like the notes on like the systems that's in Arcanum Unbounded. So on the Sellish system, she says this. I am uncertain whether their power was left to ravage the world untamed for a time or was immediately contained. This all happened during the days of human prehistory on Sel. At this point, the bulk of the investiture that made up the powers of Dominion and Devotion is trapped on the cognitive realm. Collectively, these powers, which have a polarized relationship, are called the Door. Forced together as they are, trapped and bursting to escape, they power the various forms of magic on Sel, which are multitude. That seemed to line up for me with what Wit was describing there, of the power got stuffed into Shadesmar, it's just kind of sitting there and doing weird things. But what's the other one? Trevor, you just kind of spouted out that it had to be Scadrial.
It's either Scadrial or Threnody, surely.
On one, it was all around us and we didn't realize it.
It's got to be the mists. Surely it has to be the mists.
The mists, yeah.
Okay.
I think that has to be the mists.
I didn't think about that, but you're probably right.
Does this, on my bingo card, I have that Sel is mentioned. Does this count?
Oh.
We get an allusion to Sel. It doesn't say the word Sel, but...
Oh.
Is Sel mentioned here?
I mean, we certainly mentioned it.
Of Sel.
I want to go back and listen to our episode because I thought we asked this question when we made the bingo cards. I thought we said that it had to be by name.
Yeah, I think that is correct. Sel has to, like, the word Sel has to be in the book. I think we did say that.
But if it comes down to it, and like you would score a bingo if you could get that one, we might have to call in like a third party judge or something.
We could revisit this, but for now,
I put a little asterisk on my bingo sheet of Sel is mentioned with an asterisk, and if we need to revisit, we will.
Sounds good. All right. Last little bit. We get a Kaladin point of view. Or is it a Zeth point of view? It's a Zeth point of view. No, it's a Kaladin point of view. It's a Kaladin point of view. And Kaladin and Zeth are having dialogue back and forth. Zeth makes the claim that if he were to begin to forgive himself and heal, it would lessen the impact that he's and the pain that he's caused on the world. And Kaladin has this like storms. How am I supposed to talk to this guy moment? Paul, I'll throw it to you. A point in your favor for Zeth being tragically misunderstood. However, is this recoverable for Zeth?
That has definitely been the big question for me. I think given our situation in the book and our place in the book, that this is really the first time, going back to my words, the initial treatment, if you will. I think yes. I think yes. I think we're going to learn a lot more. Like I think we're going to see some growth, but I think it's going to be slow. It's definitely going to be slow, and I don't think it's going to be a straightforward path. I could see where Zeth maybe unknowingly shares or has, you know, a healthy, honest moment with Kaladin, and then is like, I should not talk like this or something like that, or I should not be so emotional or something like that, kind of rein himself back in afterwards. I think, long story short, yes. I think we're going to go further. I don't think it's going to just keep being Kaladin beating up against a wall.
But there will certainly be progression for Zeth. However, I don't think Zeth is surviving. I think Zeth will be in a better place than where he is when he dies, but he will be dying.
I'm curious to see if the Kaladin Zeth conversations will end up arriving at like the idea of like what does Zeth deserve? Because that's his rebuttal to Kaladin's initial efforts here, where Zeth just kind of throws up, well, I deserve this. conversation over. I wonder if they're going to explore that more and if we might go down the path of like a forgiveness theme with Zeth. Can Zeth understand, or can Zeth get to a place where he sees himself as forgivable and then use that as the point to move on? Because it seems to me like if they can't have that conversation, they're not going to get anywhere.
Sure. I would love for this to explore Zeth's twisted apprenticeship of Skybreaker of justice, because that's where Zeth is approaching this from. It is yeah. He's right that I should be suffering because that is what I deserve. But balance that with forgiveness and progression, I think that could be a really, really cool conversation. I hope that's where we're going.
And that's actually really fascinating, maybe in the context of like discussions that Zeth has had with Nail, because Nail is all about the law, and the law has no room for forgiveness.
Right.
The law is black and white. It is this, it is that, this action equals this punishment. And that's where Zeth very much is at in kind of the way he views himself. So to go down the path of I can be forgiven, like maybe this concept of mercy, that seems very un-Skybreaker according to Nail.
Correct.
Ooh. And there's like hyphens in between all that.
And debonding this Heisprin that has begun manipulating Zeth and like backtracking on his justice oaths. I would love for that to go there.
Yeah, maybe.
So I'm very curious to see how this goes as far as the Skybreaker oaths and things. I think at least for a while, well, I'm conflicted on this. I think we're going to find a way to uphold the Skybreaker oaths in a more, I guess, satisfying for the reader way. Right now, Skybreakers have definitely been painted very poorly, I think, for us throughout Stormlight. We have Nail as the prime example, and then Zeth is all sorts of Zeth and overly justice-oriented and things.
Zeth is the Shallan of the Skybreakers. He has all sorts of asterisks with his situation.
That's true. Yeah, he's definitely a unique situation. Trevor, to play into one of your longtime two of your longtime theories of a fourth shard on Roshar, as well as Tien, I think those kind of go hand in hand. You were saying that Tien is, let's say, the shard of mercy. Was that
yes,
the
sir. Picture before?
That you was talked the about idea. Mercy and forgiveness. So the definition of mercy is not getting something that you deserve. Like it's I deserve to be punished, but I'm not giving you that punishment. Like, essentially, what Zeth needs. He needs a little mercy and forgiveness right now. Zeth is with Kaladin, and if we have a impactful scene where we see Tien and Kaladin once again, why would that not also be mercy towards Zeth as a catalyst?
And Kaladin has a rock that wasn't supposed to be in his pack.
Oh man, it's all coming together. The rocks. Yeah, I'm.
Oh, because like, I oh man, because
incredibly awesome.
Because Zeth like worships the rocks. If like Tien comes out of the rock,
yeah,
Zeth's gonna lose his mind.
What if Zeth's oath stone this whole time?
Oh no,
way the back.
Stone.
I don't think it's that, but. Yeah, I think it's... also, I have to make this joke because we also... unrelated. Alex and I recently watched a movie. It's an 80s movie, classic 80s movie called Romancing the Stone. And so maybe Zeth will romance the stone. You know, we get mention of it be all starting with a rock or something, so... If y'all have seen that movie, then
maybe that'll be funny. Sorry, but, I missed your reference.
To our listeners, maybe you've seen Romancing the Stone. If so, be sure to laugh for me because they have not seen it. So I thought that was a funny joke, Romancing the Stone. It's on. I told Alex I'd make this joke, and I obviously have not delivered it very well. So My apologies.
Only spot my brain is Yumi now with romance and stacking stones. That's where my brain
That's lives. True. There are a lot of stones stacked in Yumi. But I don't know. I'm, after being apprehensive towards our other what if predictions, this one, because it's Zeth related, I'm all in on, you know? But also there's a lot of little details that would pay off so nicely. Like, it could obviously lend to a massive moment for Kaladin. That's saying if Tien is Mercy specifically, right? Like that whole thing that would hopefully allow Zeth some forgiveness for himself, some reprieve and some development on his character. And then like all the things we talked about with the stones, and there's a lot of significance there you could draw.
Do you have anything, Elliot?
I have some thoughts on something that Zeth mentions about an unmade, if we're ready to go there. But if you want to...
Go ahead. That's like the last, two paragraphs of the Kaladin Zeth section?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he mentions an unmade.
This is right before we switch point of view, so it's kind of the cliffhanger we get left on. Zeth says this. I'll read it. "One of the unmade is here," Zeth said. "Awakened years before you became a Radiant, before the first oaths were sworn. My people have embraced it for some reason and welcomed in its darkness and its manipulations." That was a big ooh moment for me when I was reading, because I'm sure in the past we've like just randomly guessed that, oh, there's other unmade out there. What if one of them is in Shinovar? Like that doesn't seem crazy, but for Zeth to like just straight up say that, "I'm here to cleanse Shinovar. Oh, and by the way, there's an unmade here, and my people have embraced its darkness and its manipulations." Intriguing.
And for Zeth to know that,
yeah,
there has to be, because as far as we know, unmade, you kind of end up worshiping an unmade before you figure out exactly what you're doing, right? Because you have the thrill, you have the heart of the rebel, you're very much under the influence before you can see what's going on. And so for Zeth to know just straight up, there's an unmade here, I assume that's widespread knowledge in Shinovar, and they don't care.
Well, or another direction would be he's been named truthless, right?
Oh, okay.
What if he discovered the truth, tried to share it, got branded truthless, and is kicked out?
Okay, yeah.
That's my guess.
We know that he was branded somewhat for saying that the Radiants were back, right?
Do
we remember where that's explicitly stated?
So
it's like a long time ago, right?
That's the ongoing. Maybe? Yes, that's the ongoing dialogue in Words of Radiance. Is Kaladin starts glowing, Zeth freaks out. If you're a Radiant, then I'm not truthless. Blah blah blah. That whole book of him figuring out he's not truthless, accepting death at the end of the book. What if he realizes this is an unmade, and then makes the claim, if this is an unmade, come to steal our shard blades or, you know, influence us or whatever, then the Radiants are on their way, and that's when he's declared truthless of, no, you're wrong on both counts, this is a stone god, not an unmade.
I'm very curious to see how much Zeth flashback we get, because it feels like a late start for the book. Aside from maybe Rhythm of War with Venli, the other books were pretty forthright of like, yep, we're going to be talking a lot about the story of this person, like them in the past, right? We haven't really had any Zeth flashback, and we're thus far in.
Page count, that is true. If it makes you feel any better, it never starts in part one. We always do present day stuff, and then in part two it starts flashbacks. So we're still in.
I did not remember that. So that
we're still in part two. But you're right. As far as page count goes, we're a decent ways into the book.
Yeah. Okay. That helps a bit. Because in my head, I'm like, I feel like we're behind. And I'm wondering how much we're going to get to do. That's vastly underestimating the size of this book. But that's something I'm very eager to see is just where... Like, I think there's going to be a lot of answers in Zeth's flashback. I feel like the other flashback characters provided a lot of clarification or depth to our characters. But I feel like this might provide more answers for us on several accounts. And I'm very, very eager.
Same. The other question I now want to answer is, what unmade is this that we're going to come up against here in Shinovar? And I was tempted to just leave it at that, but then I realized we actually have a decent amount of information about at least some of the unmade now. I think we can actually narrow this down even with just the information we have. Because if we actually just step through the list, we can kind of account for or maybe rule out, I think, a few of them. Because there's only 9 of them, or at least that's what we've been told. And there's
by the Stormfather.
Yeah, I think it's Hesse's Mythica that has told us there's 9 of them. Yeah. Anyway, I don't know if Hesse's Mythica is any more credible than the Stormfather, but there's 9 of them. We've seen a bunch. So there's Ashert Marn, the Heart of the Revel, which was in Kolinar, and we kind of know the effects of that. Seems very unlikely that would be the unmade here. Next up is Ba'edel Mishram. Ba'edel Mishram is imprisoned in the spiritual realm. We've got a whole other quest line going after that. Then there's, let's see, Moloch. We know what Moloch does. Death rattles. We don't necessarily know where Moloch is, but doesn't seem like this one. Nurgaul. We know a lot about that one. That's the thrill, and we've potentially maybe theoretically taken care of that one. It's the bottom of the ocean. Ray Shafir, the Midnight Mother, was in Urethiru, and Shallan had a really cool showdown with Ray Shafir. Ray Shafir kind of like scampered off and disappeared, but I think we can rule that one out from here because the timeline wouldn't make sense here. Zeth just told us this unmade has been here a while, so I don't think it's Ray Shafir. Shah Not is the other one. I think we know a lot about Shah Not. Shah Not's off doing lots of other things. Don't think it's Shah Not fills another role. Yelignar. We've seen Yelignar a couple of times. That's the one that got swallowed by Aes Sedain and then later Amaram.
Correct.
And turns you into a crazy beast that does things. I don't know. Doesn't seem like this one. So there's 2 left. There's 2 left. And they are, I'm going to butcher some names here, Dai Ganarthus, the Black Fisher. And then lastly, this is the toughest name. My brain wants to say Kimoarish on this one, but there's probably 6 other ways you could pronounce that if you really wanted to.
Chemoarish.
Yeah. So, and Chemoarish, Kimoarish is known as the Dust Mother.
Yeah.
I think those are our 2 candidates. And
it's gotta be the Dust Mother, right?
This is where I was tying in my word dust. I think if I had to put my chips on black or red, I don't know which one of these is black, which was red, but Dust Mother, Kimoarish.
There's an obvious answer to that. One of them is called the Black Fisher.
Oh. Well, there we go. I'm putting all my chips on red.
Yeah, there we go.
All my chips are on red. The Dust Mother, I think this is gonna be this weird name we can't decide how to pronounce.
The Dust Mother.
Yes. I think it's Kimoarish, but I don't
sure.
I don't know. Haven't we seen the Black Fisher? I know we've at least gotten mention of the Black Fisher. But so, wasn't that in the we get like a I think it was a vision from Dalinar where they're in the Pure Lake? That's what I remember. There's like the lightning spren, but
that
I could be wrong.
You're thinking of the Thunderclast that he sees pull itself out of the Pure Lake. I will prove it to you that it is the Dust Mother. Here we go. two theories that are I give great credence to on where the Black Fisher has been. The Black Fisher, I think, is assigned to people specifically. And I think the Black Fisher was assigned to the Devar household back in the day, corrupting the poor young Devar men of the household. Somehow Shallan wasn't affected, but you know, maybe she was.
Janarach, you know.
Uh-huh. And then I think the Black Fisher is currently assigned to Moash. That's my big theory of, because the Black Fisher feeds off of emotion and consumes it or something like that. And
isn't there like a death rattle on that? I think there's a death rattle on that.
Yes. And so I think the Black Fisher is assigned to the Devar household because Lindavar doesn't feel the pain that he's causing to the household. One of the boys has like this gambling addiction that he doesn't understand the pain that he's causing to the household. Another one of the boys tortures crabs in his pastime and doesn't feel a thing. And it's mentioned over and over that he doesn't feel a thing about it. Moash currently does not feel a thing. And that's mentioned a dozen times in Rhythm of War. And then his feeling is restored to him when he's expelled from the tower. So I think the Unmade was expelled from the tower and then returned to Moash like immediately. And so he briefly felt emotion anyway. And Odium was trying to assign the Black Fisher to Dalinar at the end of Oathbringer. Give me your pain. I can give you the Black Fisher. Surrender your pain, etc., etc. That I give a lot of credence to that. That's not only my theory. The other people have tacked on to some parts of that. The Dust Mother. I think the Dust Mother may be what the shamans are about to tell Zeth. It's a spren of the stones. I think this may be a corrupted spren of the stones. Like, this was originally their deity and became an unmade, so it's actually both. Yeah. That the Radiants are going to return, there's an unmade here, and the shamans are like, shut up, this is the stone lady goddess, how dare you say that, get out of here. But Zeth is, you know, freaking out that it's now corrupted, and they don't buy that. That's where I think we're going. This is the Dust Mother, or at least it was a one time.
I like it. And if true, could fill in, I think, some much needed details on some of our final unmade. Like, we kind of know what some of the others are about, but some of these last few we know very little. Maybe we're headed for more info pretty soon here.
I think so. Anything else before we close this episode?
Big episode over two chapters.
Yeah.
So
I'm
excited to keep reading.
I enjoyed these chapters a lot. These were probably my favorite two chapters of the book so far. I feel like we're starting to get into the meat of it. We're starting to really get a little brain bendy with where this might go. So I'm getting excited.
I am as well. I greatly enjoyed this episode and that discussion. Thank you for joining me, Paul and Ilya.
See ya next time.
Toodles. Did that just to make you mad, Trevor?
I think you're three for three in a row.